I've become a real believer in managing the energy of a team and not having these huge bursts that you go through, because I don't think they're super healthy from a longevity standpoint of an organization. I think they can come and go, but if you can eliminate from them being extreme, which I think we see a lot of extremeness, I think you can actually get a lot more out of people.
Hey, it's Adam Schoenfeld. Welcome back to the Built in Seattle podcast, where Seattle's top entrepreneurs, investors, and leaders share their stories and their lessons from behind the scenes. If you like this show, then you'll love my short weekly email, the Pike Street Journal. Subscribe at psj.email. Each week, I send some bonus nuggets from these interviews, stuff I get when the recorder's off, and some more insider takes on Seattle people and companies. That's psj.email. On this episode, I met with Juliana Stancompiano. She's the CEO at Oxygen. They're a consulting firm focused on sales enablement and workforce education. Juliana is also the author of Radical Outcomes, a business book published by Wiley, and she's the president of the Sales Enablement Society. Her story started with buying Oxygen out of bankruptcy back in 2008. She talked about that experience, the process for writing her book, and the leadership lessons that she's learned from running Oxygen and working with clients like Microsoft, F5, and REI. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Juliana. I'm here with the one, the only, Juliana Stancompiano. Hey, Juliana, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Adam, thanks for having me.
We had a mutual friend who highly recommended talking to you, and so strong signal about you out there in the world.
I appreciate it. I thought it was funny that I said, hey, what did he say about me? It was like, Corey said we should connect.
Isn't that funny that sometimes you'll just trust somebody, even if they don't give you any context?
Exactly. That's great.
I wanted to dig right into the story of Oxygen. I know you bought Oxygen out of bankruptcy and have turned it around and grown it over a dozen plus years. I'm very interested to just start there and hear that backstory.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I don't always tell everybody. So it's interesting to be on a podcast and now talk about it. I tell people when they ask, and a lot of people don't ask about how you founded a company. And I personally try to make it a point to ask a lot of founders of like, how did it actually happen? Because I've found that there's a lot of diverse stories in that space. Yeah, so I started working for Oxygen in the UK, actually. It was a UK-based company called Oxygen Learning at the time. And I had been in Europe for about 4 years, and I was interested in coming back closer to home. And so I made it my mission to be able to open an office in the US. And I opened an office in Seattle in 2008. And typically when I say that point in the story, people go, oh, so 2008, the economy fell out from underneath us, and a lot of businesses stopped. And interestingly, I think it was a great opportunity to start a business, which is what we also see through the economic downturns is businesses being started. And I started Oxygen in July 2008. And then the unfortunate part is the UK business took a really hard hit. And so they went into what they call administration, which is our form of bankruptcy. And I worked through that. I actually became a director in the business there. And I tried to work to see if we could save the entire company, and it didn't work out. And so out of their closing of that business, I bought the US business because in turn, we had clients and we were starting to grow. And we had a very small team at the time, which allowed us for that agility and flexibility to keep moving.
So the business was struggling. The economy was not in good shape. What was it that gave you confidence to make that move? And what was the internal dialogue like around that decision?
This is a great question. I think that I was very naive, and that's super helpful. I was also still fairly young, and I thought I could do anything. And then ultimately, I had paying customers, and I had employees that I was paying, and I was providing healthcare for. And we were watching everything just fall apart around us. And I thought, if I can keep this going, why wouldn't I? And so that was really. It's not a lot deeper than that. I was also pregnant with my first kid at the time. And I literally signed the paperwork the day before my birthday. And then I had him the day after my birthday. And so my husband always reminds me of all that timing that just happened. So So I closed on the business and then had a first kid as well. And in going through the process, the UK was asking me, what if they come back and say, you made this happen so that you could buy the business? And I was like, I know you can't see me at the time because we didn't have video conferencing then. I said, but I'm like 7 months pregnant. And the last thing I really want to do right now is buy a business. I thought I was going to have a maternity leave. And it just, it's not how it happened.
How much was it something that you had wanted to do versus the opportunity presenting itself because of those circumstances? Did you have the mindset of wanting to, you know, run your own business coming in and you saw this opportunity? Or was it more driven by just, hey, we have this team, we have this market traction, I don't want to let this go? What was the balance there?
I think that there is probably a bit of both. And primarily I say that because I took entrepreneurship in college. I had that bent. I like to figure out things and why they work and how they work. And just opening an office alone, not within even the country that you're in, is a huge undertaking. And nobody in the UK knew how to open a business in the US. So this was a huge learning for everybody as we went through it. And it was a big learning for me about how the UK business worked as vice versa. So I definitely had a bent towards wanting to do that and to grow this. And I had a passion for what we did and thought it was very viable. And my whole goal when I joined, because they'd been a client before when I was in-house at Microsoft, was to bring it to the US because I felt like the US really needed what we provided.
You mentioned that being naive helped you. How quickly did you start to realize that you were naive to certain challenges, and what challenges started to come up that were surprising as you had purchased the business and then you were trying to turn it around?
Yeah. So I don't know if many people purchased a service business, but really beyond a certain size, you're not buying a lot. So that was probably my first, wait a second, I just bought a bunch of documents. And I have to figure out how to move everything from the UK to the US from a document perspective, which was just not nearly as sophisticated or easy as it is today. I literally had what I called our hard drive, which was like an external hard drive that I plugged into my machine and I connected to the UK server and I left it running for 3 days to download all the documents. That was probably my first awakening. And then I've been told through the years, people are like, oh, I love the name of the company. And I think that is one of the best things that I bought was the name and the rights to be able to use it in the US. But a lot of what I had bought, I very quickly realized wasn't why people were hiring us. They were hiring us for a design kind of methodology and mindset versus the IP or content that I had bought. I think it came crashing down fairly quickly. And then I realized I actually had to build a whole new business. And that was very intimidating when that reality set in, where I was like, oh, I have to figure out who we are and what we stand for and what we're doing. And I hadn't thought about that.
And so am I right that you're figuring those things out while you have active clients and while you have employees? So you're building the airplane while you're flying it.
Completely. Yeah. So we were delivering on work and doing work and then codifying what it was that we were doing at the same time to be able to go and sell that, which was really around the design methodology that we used versus how we were selling was around like different areas that people needed help in, communications or leadership or those kind of areas. And a phrase that's said a lot in our industry is that it, or has been said a lot, is content is king, and was said a lot back then. And I think because we didn't have the access that we do today, and I started to realize also very quickly that I actually don't believe that content is king. The right content is important for somebody to get, but there are 70,000 plus leadership books out there. And I became very quickly like, pick one. I don't care which one you pick. They all can boil down to a lot of the same principles. But I think what's important for our organizations is that we pick a sales methodology, or we pick a sales approach, or we pick a leadership approach, and we stick with that, and we teach that, and we do that, right? Versus one being better or more special than the other.
Got it. Yeah, certainly there's a zillion leadership books, and in the space you're in sales and sales enablement, there's another, you know, couple million titles about spin selling and this selling and challenger sale. And so I can see that.
We've created content around all of them.
And it's all of them. So what's the cycle that organizations get into around where does the content is king mentality trip people up?
I think that's, and there are still plenty of businesses out there, that's how they sell what they do, right? It's IP. Ken Blanchard was a huge business being run. Franklin Covey is a huge business being run on the IP and that thought leadership. And that there's those kind of areas and domains and same things, been selling and SPI, Sales Professional International, that was one of the ones that was, they own solution sales. And Blanchard bought Mahan Khosa's book that I thought was really amazing. So there's a lot of that out there and people are still selling it based on the IP. And if you go down that route and use that, then you can do that. But there are a lot of more modern ways, I think, of using that material that isn't what we were looking at when it was 2008, which was the more heavy models of we're going to pay millions of dollars and have access to this versus kind of the subscription model that a lot of us are a part of today.
Do people have a belief that the framework is some sort of magic, that if I can just implement this proven methodology or framework, then I will succeed?
Yes.
Okay.
Rarely is it the framework or the process that is the said problem. I say in quotes, you know, it's typically something else when you dig into it. And I think that's the interesting part about what we do is when you get the opportunity to really dig into what's going on, you find a breakdown between the products that are being built and the sales conversations that are happening or what customers' expectations are and the delivery. And you start to actually find what's going on versus a process is a process. And it's the same thing I tell clients, I don't really care what your sales process is, just pick one, you know, and it's an aspect of what sellers do. And it's typically more from a reporting perspective and knowing where things are at in our pipeline and what the forecast is going to be. So it's more meant for the operations side of the business than it is for the actual salesperson knows that you skip around a lot in a sales process and it's not linear. And it, as much as we wish it was a straight line, it's not. And sometimes you have to go forward and sometimes you back up and you hope to get through all of them and close the deal.
Yeah. How do you get people past that of that mentality of thinking, oh, the process is everything and the framework, and we just have to find that magical framework, and into the mindset of thinking about sticking with it, consistency, and how you implement it correctly?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes down to you start asking people about it. Was the process your magic bullet when you were selling? Or what was your magic bullet? Did you have one? Shoot, there is no magic bullet. Now what do we do? When you start hearing other people's stories, especially sales leaders, they have years and years of battle wounds and experience and good conversations and bad conversations. And they go, okay, I get it. And then you can have the conversation of, yes, we totally agree you need a process, but let's land on it and figure out what works for right now. Let's not belabor it. And then let's also dig into what else is needed to help support your sellers.
Coming back to the turnaround a little bit, I know you now have clients like Microsoft, Sony, Big Fish Games, Starbucks, Expedia, the list goes on. When you wind back the clock to when you signed those papers and you're about to have your baby, did you think that you'd be able to have this kind of success and have those kind of clients, or did you exceed expectations?
That's an interesting question. So I think in part, my naivety was like, of course I'll go out and do this. And I think you need some of that to be able to go out and do it. And then the other side was like, wow, this is a lot harder than I expected it to be. So it's a double-edged sword there. And I probably got way more grateful as I started to actually build a business and try to get new clients and get new clients in than going into it. I thought it would be a lot easier than it actually was, which I think is why I did it. I don't know if you knew how long a sales cycle was or like how many times you'd have to hear no or all the rejection. I don't know if you'd be like, sign me up. I want to go do that.
So in a way that made it possible to dive in, and then so now I can't go back. I'm in this.
Yeah. And it comes like, what do I have to lose? And I think that's the beauty of being younger and not having responsibilities and all of these things, because at the end of the day, if it didn't work out, I wasn't really bothered.
Now that you have more experience, do you ever draw on that principle in decision making now, where you try to put aside some of the known challenges and skepticism in order to act more naively and moving in a direction?
Yeah, it's almost the doing it intentionally. And I've talked about this with sellers of, if you just let go of kind of the quotas or the all those things, sometimes it's freeing. And I'll say this to my team, so it doesn't work out, is what it is. Not everything works out. And luckily, we're not scientists trying to cure cancer. I think there'd be a lot more pressure on us. And yet, we're also, you can get so serious about what you do. And sometimes you just have to lighten it up and realize that something else will be there if it doesn't work out.
I love that. Yeah, I find it hard as I've gotten older to bring that levity to life.
Yes, I've been trying to do it a lot lately, too. You know what? We have obviously zero control over what's going to be happening.
I know you have kids like I do, and they certainly help with that. But yeah, I still get in my own little loops of, this will never work.
Totally. And what I always find too is like, is to find somebody that's not in my world and run it by them and see what their reaction is. And that's an interesting way of getting out of your own circle, like you said, that you run in, and there's lots of people that we probably talk to on a regular basis. And if you throw it by somebody that's not in your world at all, it's always interesting to get their reaction to it.
What does that conversation look like? How do you reach out? How do you present the problem or the situation to that third party?
Typically, it's somebody that I know that's a friend, but they're just not in my world. They're not in my work world. And you get a very different perspective. And I appreciate that. I think it's fascinating. You're like, or I'll tell them, they'll be like, I have no idea what you just said. And I was like, oh, that's the problem. People outside of our world can't understand that. Maybe we should think about the language we're using to describe something and find a new way.
I love that. That's such a great, simple insight that so often I've skipped that step so many times.
Right. Yeah, I have too, to be fair.
Let's change gears a little bit and talk about sales, since so much of your time and energy goes to helping companies of all shapes and sizes build their sales process and enable their sales force. What do great sales teams look like? If somebody's starting a company or coming into an early stage company, what's the North Star on what sales should look like?
I think it's such an amazing question. And I will say that while we do a lot of work with all different size companies, I've also gone through it myself as a small business and trying to find, and I've been through a decent amount of salespeople trying to figure this out for myself. And a few years ago, I read an article, and I think this is very illuminating from a founder's perspective, that says, for your first salesperson, go and hire somebody that sells the exact same way that you do. Because in some way, Adam, you sell what your company does. That is a part of what you do, even if you don't have a sales background. And actually, not many people have a sales background, because we are just now getting an educational system in place from an academic perspective of to be a seller when you come out of undergrad or graduate school. But I read that, and then I went out and I've hired a salesperson that is like, that we do. We've gotten along for so many years. We always got together every like 6 months and would have chats about what was going on and what we were seeing, very similar values, very similar ways in which we sell. And after I read that, I went up and I was like, I need to hire you because I actually believe this is probably accurate, because I've done it the wrong way so many times, where I'm like, I need somebody with lots of experience, or I need somebody that's done all these other things than I have done, or I need somebody different than me, is what I kept going down. And I actually realize that somebody like me is probably going to be able to come in and start growing in it. And it has worked. So I think from that, hiring your first salesperson, I think that that's really good advice, especially when you hold this thing that like means so much to you. And then you can start like letting go of that control of what that looks like. And he definitely does things different than I do, which is great, but we hold the same kind of moral values about how we go about doing it.
So in what dimensions are you looking for somebody that's the same as you, and what dimensions might they be different? I love this idea. It's Matt McElwain was on the podcast and he talked about founder market fit. This is like founder seller fit. So in what dimensions is it really important, do you think, to align versus which ones can you be possibly very different?
Yeah, he comes from a similar industry right? So he understands the industry that we're in, but I have been a practitioner founder. So I also get in and do work, and he doesn't do the work. And so I think that's a huge difference between the two of us, and also important for him to not do the work, because you can get sucked into the work and then you don't have sales, which we've probably also all been a part of on some level. And so his sole focus is selling, and he has much more of the go find new companies and new leads and really tenacious in that aspect that is different. And I think that when you think about somebody that is you, it's not necessarily like you in the job that you do, but like you in how you approach your work and how you approach customers. And he and I are both very solid in like creating strong relationships, being really authentic with people, saying when we can do it, when we can't do it. It's that kind of approach that he and I have a lot of synergies on. And we can bounce things off of each other. Hey, I just talked to someone, this is how it went. How would you approach it? Do you have any advice on this thing that I'm stuck on? And we're almost always in sync about how we'd approach something.
Have you seen that principle ring true in your client work, where when they have that fit between sort of the leader, the founder, and the early sellers, that it works better in some way?
In the early stage, very early stage, yes. And typically that person then, as you grow, if you're in the tech company, I see that they become the VP of sales, and they end up then with a team underneath them. And then probably the next group is going to be more of your like SDR inside sales type of seller that's really going to be able to get the brand out, do the marketing, get the leads in. It's that lead generation, which is almost this, it's this marketing demand generation and inside sales combination that really starts to spin up the fast growth for the companies.
I know that you describe the work you do as sales enablement. I'd love to just hear what your definition of sales enablement is, because it's maybe a loaded term. And how should operators think about sales enablement as they're scaling their companies?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's lots and lots of definitions out there. So I'm not going to claim to have one. I think what was interesting about when I first learned about it is that I think I've been doing a form of sales enablement my entire career, to be frank. And so we always laugh about people claiming so many years of sales enablement, because it didn't really exist until that 2005-ish timeframe, 4 or 5 is when it was really becoming something from an analyst perspective and a definition perspective of what it is. And that came out in like 2008, I think. And so we've really been on that side of how do you enable sellers? And I look at it as education, being able to find the assets that they need when they need them. And then we look at sales enablement from a, what's the technology that you're using to provide all these things to sellers? Can it all be done through a CRM? And typically it's a no, but that's where sellers are at on a constant basis. So how do we feed everything through there so that they can get what they need when they need it in order to have successful customer conversations and get the next conversation and eventually close the deal? So look at it as that, what's the life cycle of a seller and interaction with the customer, and then what are all those touch points and how do we help enable those touch points to happen?
Yeah. How do you, in that enablement strategy and execution, how are you balancing the needs of the end customer versus the needs of the seller?
Yeah. So the needs of the seller, I'm hoping, are defined by what the customer needs are, right? So if you start with your customer and work backwards from them, you can typically lay out, we like to talk about customer conversations and what each one of those may look like and how do we prepare for those. And I always look at a measure of success as, did I get the next conversation? Did I get the next conversation? Did I get the next conversation? Until you're eventually, and then it's, did I get the ask for and a proposal? Did I get the ask to actually win the work, et cetera? And those are all those milestones that happen. But if you break down the customer conversations, then you can enable the seller to be able to be prepared for those conversations.
I love that's such a simplifying way to think about it. I think in my head, all these things have been too complicated and they have all these names, but you're just, it's a series of conversations that leads to a business relationship.
And it's complicated. And you're right, it is very complicated. And I have found, even for myself and for our clients, it's helpful when you can break it down by each of the conversations, because then it's tangible And then you're like, okay, I get it. You might have a sales conversation that you're going in and you're going to be meeting somebody for the first time and they want to hear about you and you need to hear about them. So how do we set up what a good conversation looks like in that moment? And it's probably not you go in, throw up your deck and start talking to them. I think a lot of us would know that you're going to go in and you're going to have small talk and you're going to need to learn about them and get to know each other a little bit. And then you're going to want to ask questions about them. And you have to also be prepared to answer questions about yourself, but not give them the whole truck.
No, I love that.
So when you break it down, it becomes a lot easier to enable to.
And I think for founders or early stage operators, it's you maybe have this like Glengarry, Glenn Ross salesperson, Alec Baldwin in your head. And really, that's not what it is. Yeah, right. And the conversation aspect and what does a good conversation look like, that seems very clarifying. I want to switch gears a little bit here. And I noticed that you've been running this business, you're president of the Sales Enablement Society, you're a mom, and then you found time to write a book in there. Can you give me just the quick, like, what motivated you to write the book? I'll just start there.
Yeah, the motivation is I was actually approached by Wiley to write a book, and I reached out to somebody that I know that had written a book, and he wrote back to me, and I'll never forget this, and he said, there are lots and lots of people, thousands of people out there that have a book that they've written, and they have no publisher. You've been approached by a publisher, write the book. I was like, oh, okay, I guess I should. So it was like, at first it was almost out of obligation of like, somebody's approached me, that is an amazing ask. And so I need to go do this, even though it's very scary.
Why did they approach you? What got you on their radar and what made that happen?
Yeah, my website, what they were reading on the site. So basically they went out and did research and she reached out and said, hey, I think that you have a book in you and I'd be curious to know if you think you do and can you write up, basically they have you write up like a one pager overview of what the book could be about. And so I did that and then they put it in, and I like have these images of what these meetings look like because it's a black box and I have no idea. They have an editorial meeting every week and they look at these one pagers and I imagine these people run a board, oh, this is crap. this could be viable kind of thing. And she got back to me and said, yep, there's interest. We'd like to go forward with it and I can send you a contract. I was like, okay,
wow,
we're doing this.
So it was more, yeah, it was like jumping on an opportunity that came. How has having the book been impactful for your business?
Yeah, it's been great. So from a services business perspective, it's another rung in the ladder of we actually know what we're talking about. We have experience and a lot of thoughts behind this to actually put a book together. So it helps a lot in the sales cycle to be able to have that behind us.
How, if at all, did it help you clarify or codify some of your principles and ideas?
It helped a lot. And what was interesting about it is, I will say my timeline between when she first approached me and when I actually signed the contract was well over a year. Because at first I was like, oh my gosh, like a blank page. It's like your mind goes blank and you're like, I have nothing to say. And then we did a bunch of creation of a lot of different things in that time. And we'd created this whole online experience. And I looked at one of the people that I work with, Catherine, and I said, oh my gosh, this is the chapters of the book. And it just landed. And then it felt a lot less intimidating once we'd already we had a creation of a structure, essentially, of chapters of books. And ironically, that's not how the chapters ended up laying out, but it was enough to feel confident to be able to go and write the book.
Wow, that's incredible that, well, the seed planted so long ago and then that moment where it lit up, oh, this is how we're going to do the book.
Yeah.
I love that. You see a lot more tech companies publishing books now. And so I'm always fascinated in that process.
Yeah. And it's an interesting process. I think ultimately it's about book sales. So ironically, what we're talking about, everything comes back to selling something. And when you have a publisher, you have some control. But when you're a first-time author, you really have no control. Write something. And I was given a title and I thought that was a joke. She was like, here's the title of your book. And I was like, that's not the title of my book. She was like, no, we've done research and we have pulled people and this is the title they like. And I just, it's an interesting process.
Do you have another book in you? Can we expect a second book at some point?
More than likely, there will be a second book at some point. It's always interesting. It's like having kids. Everybody starts to ask you when you're going to have the next one. Once you've had one, you're like, I had one. You know, let's enjoy this one.
Right.
I'll get to the next one. I'm not there yet.
And I will put a link in the show notes, but for people listening, the book is called Radical Outcomes, and you can get it on Amazon or wherever you buy your books. I just picked it up and have started going through it. I'm very excited. There's one idea I wanted to click down on in the book with you is you talk about how companies are relying on magic and it's costing them crazy amounts of money. That section really resonated with me. Can you talk about what magic means in that context?
Yeah, I think we see this a lot. And as leaders, I think sometimes we make this even more pervasive because we're like, I just need you to go do X. I just need Y done. Can you just go do it? And you don't want to think it takes as long as it takes for something to happen, especially something strategic for your company. And that's what we talk about. There's like this black box that you don't want to know how it actually happens, and you just want the thing done. And so a lot of what I was trying to uncover is that in order to create these things that we think are important for people to go through or to have to be successful at work, there's a lot of work that goes into that. And I myself have had those moments where I'm like, oh, don't tell me, I know it's going to take a lot of effort to do this. Can we just do it kind of thing? And we've all been probably parts of those sprints where you feel like you're like pushing a boulder uphill and it's so much time and so much effort and you get there and everybody's burnout. And that's not a great place to be. And so I've come, as I've probably matured in just business and realistic expectations and things like that, I've become a real believer in like managing the energy of a team and not having these huge bursts that you go through, because I don't think they're super healthy from a longevity standpoint of an organization. I think they can come and go, but if you can eliminate from them being extreme, which I think we see a lot of extremeness, I think you can actually get a lot more out of people. And I think if you uncover how work actually gets done, we can be better at managing our people and those that are doing the work. We can help them manage that a lot better and be a lot more effective and efficient in how they actually do the work to get places in faster, like shorter sprints that aren't huge uphill climbs.
How does that actually look, managing that energy in more of a sustained way versus these cyclical crazy death marches?
Yeah, I think we're really good at those death marches.
You know, as leaders, that's a tendency.
Yeah, you're like, oh, we're going to have a big push and let's all get on board. You've got it. I'm going to buy you food for the next 6 weeks and it's going to be amazing. Yeah, although not healthy in probably so many ways, like sleep, food, like all those things. And I was listening to a podcast with Tom Brady the other day, and like, regardless where you fall in the football line, because I'm not a huge Patriots fan, he's an amazing athlete. He's had a lot of these different way, but it's like the sleep, the food, like they all make a difference, an incremental difference, even when you're at the top of your game. And I think it's the same thing in business, and it's every day, and it's consistency and it's managing. When something does happen, it's like taking the energy down a notch. Okay, I hear you. I know we really messed up on that, but let's talk about this. Like, it's okay. Tomorrow's a new day. Like, let's figure out how we're going to deal with it. And from a leadership perspective, if you can bring that kind of calm and it's all good, you bring people's energy down, then they can think rationally and they can like actually help you solve the problem. Versus they can get really spun up about something. And then you're like, oh my gosh, we've just spent how many hours dealing with this thing that's not a big deal. That's not ideal if you're trying to run at a steady rate. And so it's a day-to-day, a person-to-person management as well. And so I think one of the other key things is knowing your people well and knowing what stresses them out and what doesn't stress them out. And then managing those things for them, because it's going to be different for every single individual that's on your team. And it's imperative that you get to know what those things are so you can help manage it.
I love that. And obviously, if people want to run far instead of just fast for a little while, then
yeah,
doing that could be so impactful. I love those stories. I've learned a lot from this. I could probably keep you here for a couple hours, but it's time to wrap up with the Supersonic Six. So this is your rapid fire round. Number one, how much coffee do you drink?
I have one cup of coffee. It's basically like a grande coffee a day.
Number two, what's one other Seattle company that you're following or studying right now?
Oh my gosh, Canlis right now. They've just been like changing and navigating like I didn't think I would ever see them do. So this week they announced that they're doing a community college, Canlis Community College, for $25, and the proceeds are going to Fair Start. It's been incredible. They've come up with their bagel, the bagel shack, the crab shack, the food delivery service. Like, I just keep, and this one like also threw me for, I was like, oh my gosh, I did not expect to see that coming.
Number three, who's one Seattle person that you're following or learning from right now?
Michaela Kiner. She is the founder and CEO of a company called Reverb. They do a lot of work in the smaller tech from an HR perspective, and she just wrote Female Firebrands. She's got a lot of great stuff that I follow and watch. I think she's really phenomenal.
Number four, what's one thing that Seattle needs to improve as a startup hub?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think we need to be more inclusive. And I think that we have a lot of work to do and introspection to do on that front. I've talked to a number of founders, and I don't know how it was for you. I don't know the story, but I think knowing those stories, I think Seattle was the hardest part of me opening a business. I was like, oh my gosh, nobody will let me in. Let me in. And then it was like, once I got in, it was like, oh my gosh, people, like, it took so much time to build a community. And that, I don't think that really helps innovation or startups.
Number five, what's one piece of advice you'd give your 20-year-old self?
I'd probably say just trust yourself and what you think.
Number six, what can this community do to help you? Do you have something that you have coming up you want people to pay attention to, or a job opening, or anything you want listeners to go do?
Yeah, we are constantly looking for people. So absolutely, if there are people that are in that learning or enablement space, that we would love to know you and who you are. I'd be happy to set you up with people on my team. And then SES is having a big conference at the end of October, and it's going to be fun and a big connection point. And sitting on the board, I have to plug it.
Yeah. Okay. Where should they go to sign up for the conference?
Then go to scsociety.org and find the registration from there.
Okay. And you're figuring out, is this going to be virtual?
Oh, yes. It is virtual. And we've got a lot of fun new ways to engage. Engagement's really a big deal for this community. And so we've got different things that are going to be happening of ask the experts or join these pods where you wouldn't necessarily get to just talk to these people on a regular basis. And they'll be in there hosting conversations and chats and things like that. So I'm excited to see how it goes. It's also like covering different time zones. We expect it to be a global audience.
Juliana, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Hey, it's Adam again. Quick note before you go. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you're enjoying the show as much as I am enjoying making it. If you do like it, please leave a rating or a review. That would help other people find it in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And if you have any feedback, send me an email, adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com. No underscores, no periods, just adamseattlepodcast@gmail.com.